doors closing. This is Chicago and State. Saturday night. What is the source? Where is the heart? Maybe you're in the kitchen of a 24-hour grill on a Saturday night. Or driving a car. Working in a tattoo parlor. You could be pulling into a truck stop for a liter of Mountain Dew. The red kind. You could be sitting up chairs in a storefront church. Perhaps you are in a jail looking for a dash of freedom. Maybe you are a cab driver at an airport watching the fickle lines of arrivals and departures. What keeps you moving in these final few hours of a Saturday when all the deals are done? Is it love? Is there something you see in an old mirror? An escape from loneliness? Secrets covered with flowers and dirt? I've touched all those bases, and that could be why I am here. You see, you can't see boundaries at night, but you can smell the fuel from an open road. At night, it seems you are not in the world any longer. The world is in you. And when the world is in you, there are few rules. Things can be better on a Saturday night. You are in control, unlike the rest of the working week. So you listen with an open mind. You settle in and wait for moments. You may go to places you've never been before. I'm Dave Hoekstra, and this is Nocturnal Journal. Thanks for joining us tonight. And our first guests are Deborah Carr, the Executive Director of the Intuit, the Center for Intuitive and Outsider Art, and Cleo Wilson, President 2002-2006, and a founding board member of Intuit. And you've got the Mr. Imagination exhibition coming on January 9th, opening. But first, tell us what Intuit is about and what it is.
Well, thanks for having us, Dave. Intuit's a really special place, and there may be some Chicagoans that don't know it. It's a museum located on Milwaukee Avenue, just at Chicago Avenue. So great spot, right off the Blue Line Chicago stop. And we have two galleries in there, a permanent exhibit on Henry Darger, and some other cool stuff. But the exciting thing about Intuit is that it is the home of intuitive and outsider art, not just in Chicago, but we're the only museum in the United States dedicated solely to outsider art.
It's at 756 North Milwaukee Avenue?
That's right.
Right by the Matchbox.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And how long have you been in that location? Were you in other locations before that?
Well, this is really our first permanent home. We've been there since 98. Before that, Intuit was started in 1991. And our first home was at the Roger Brown Studio, home and studio. And prior to that, we had pop-up exhibits. We didn't know the term at that time, but that was really what it was. And we were having exhibits in different spaces throughout the city. And then when Roger decided that he would give his home and studio to the School of the Art Institute, we had to find a space, and we were fortunate to get the space we're currently in.
Now, the operative thing is, how do you define intuitive and outsider art? How do you explain that to people? What is that? What is it and what isn't it? This is an outsider type radio show.
The easiest answer is it's art by artists that are not trained at an art school. So it's outside what's called the academy. For a long time, before this work was really introduced in this country, you know, it was introduced in Europe at the turn of the century. And when those outsiders were people that were just in mental institutions, the term came to the United States, the term outsider was used. In Europe, it was called art brut, raw, uncooked. Mm-hmm. When it came here, it became outsider art. It was a phrase that was coined to be an exact description, although it's not. But the American interpretation is much broader. It's not limited to people who are institutionalized.
Yeah, right. Are there common names in the genre? I mean, I know like Howard Finster. I mean, give me some things people might be able to identify with.
Henry Darger,
right.
A lot of people in Chicago know Lee Godey.
Right.
And then, of course, Mr. Imagination.
What were your paths into this? You were at the Shedd Aquarium, right?
Right. I was at Shedd Aquarium for 17 years, and I left 4 years ago because I was really interested in the need for museums, in my opinion, to be more relevant to emerging audiences. For me, I'm a lifelong museum geek, museum lover, and museums were drawing some criticism around their attendance fees, or were they really in touch with their emerging audiences, new audiences. We oftentimes think of museum goers as being, older folks, for instance. And I was looking at some of the research that was being done at that time about research that was done by, for instance, the Institute for Museum and Library Services, saying that the public actually trust museums more than corporate or government or even academic sectors, and they want museums to recommend action and be a voice for advocacy. And that was something that was kind of new to museums a bit 4 years ago. They would advocate for themselves, of course. But I started an organization called Youth Muse, and my focus was on helping the cultural sector be more relevant and using young people as kind of the leverage for that. The same research I was looking at also showed that the public trusts young people, teenagers, as change agents, and most museums have teens in their programs already. So I was working with organizations to help them leverage their teens and activate their teens to speak on behalf of the museum in some area of social good, be it environment or social justice or arts and creativity. And when I first got introduced to Intuit about a year ago, because they brought me on board to help them start a teen program.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah.
I got so excited because I saw so much potential for the kind of work that was represented by this art. It's art that you don't really need. You certainly don't need an art degree to appreciate it, but you could just walk in the door if you're a teenager, or if you're just someone who maybe doesn't know art or doesn't feel comfortable looking at art. It's very accessible. Some of it's very fun. Some of it's very serious. Some of it's sort of scary. But it's all art that you can look at and say, hey, I want to know the story, or hey, I like this or that. It feels familiar in some ways.
From my seat, I mean, the connection with kids, I mean, is there also an innocence to it, or is that a too broad a word?
I think certainly when you look at Henry Darger's work, and Henry is, native Chicago and one of the most well-known outsider artists in the world. But I think that if you look at his artwork, there's definitely sort of an innocence, a sweetness, innocent sort of vanquishing forces of evil, or bad guys, if you will.
But then it goes to the other extreme as well, where he's eviscerating little girls, and so it could be innocence in the way that teenage boys like to draw people being stabbed or something. But it's very some of it is pretty dicey, I would say.
You've been, Cleo, what was your path into this? I know you, but I don't know how you got involved in this.
How did I get involved?
Yeah.
I saw a show, actually, in 1983, maybe it was in 1984, and it was at the Field Museum called Black Folk Art in America, and it was a show that was organized by the Corcoran Museum that was traveling. And truthfully, the only reason I went to see this show is because it had Black in the name, and I wanted to see what it was. I had no idea what I was going to see. And when I walked in to the gallery, the thing that I remember was this huge painting that had been on a Coke sign. So I could see the raised letter Coca-Cola, behind the painting that was on the sign. And the painting was of a guy, very large and very colorful, and it said Dr. Buzz, and he was holding a conch shell, a real conch shell that had been glued to it. And I walked in here, and I walked in a little bit, and I looked at this stuff, and I said, maybe I'm in the wrong place. So I backed up, went back, and at that time I decided to read what was there about what the exhibit was, and it was life-changing for me.
Does this make it more museums and art? Does it make it a little more accessible? Does it break down some preconceived walls and stuff?
This art?
Yeah.
I think it totally breaks down. It's one of the things that you get it. You know, it's not an insider's joke. And that's the part that I appreciate about it the most. You know, it touches you, like Deb was saying. It's visceral. You know what it's about when you see it. It doesn't take any special understanding or insider track to know what it's about.
Are you open to everything? Is there something that doesn't fall into the parameters of that?
Yeah, we're interested in art by untrained artists, and so. It might be a special occasion where you would, you know, want to show a trained artist with a self-taught, you know, just to as a point to make. But that is our focus, and our mission is to show work by self-taught artists. So.
And many times the mainstream artists or the trained artists have been heavily influenced by the outsider artists.
Mm-hmm. I don't like to use that word. But
was Grandma Moses an outsider artist?
Grandma Moses is a self-taught artist. Yeah. Yes, she's not an outsider.
No. Okay, all right. Okay. We'll get to Mr. Imagination here in a minute, but what's been your most successful exhibit thus far? I mean, in terms of like attention and numbers and things like that.
Well, the ones that really draw the heaviest tend not to be work by self-taught. There have been some vernacular photography. I think we did a show of mugshots that drew
a lot
of people. And I mean, they were actual mugshots I think they were all black and white and all before the 80s or something when the police departments were getting rid of their mugshots. And other shows that have drawn really well have been related to Found, that magazine and those things. But those types of shows aside, I think almost anything with Henry Darger really draws audiences. From all over the world, people come.
And why is that? With Henry.
He's probably the most well-known, like Deb said, yeah. And I think his art is probably the most sophisticated, I guess, we're seeing things like that his work is innocent, but I mean, there is a...
It's detailed, for sure.
A detail, yeah. And a level of sophistication that he had that allowed him, a person who didn't think he could draw... to create a way to make these 12 and 15 foot very detailed panels that he came up with his own techniques for doing that. And I think that's one of the things about this art.
Yeah. I think the other thing about Henry Darger's work is that when you get up close to it, you begin to feel like you're in another world.
Oh, yeah.
And he's really created his own... alternative universe. I just saw the last Hobbit show and I was thinking, oh, Henry creates a whole universe, a land, and he has all these stories that he illustrates that happen in that land.
Yeah. We're going to take a break and then we'll talk about the Mr. Imagination exhibit in a minute. Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. I'm Dave Hoekstra, and we're here with Deborah Carr and Cleo Wilson of Intuit. And you're here to talk about the Mr. Imagination exhibit. Tell us who Gregory Warmack / Mr. Imagination was. It's a fascinating story.
Well, Mr. I is a Chicagoan, a Chicago native. He was born here in 1948 and lived most of his life in Chicago. And when he was a young man, he was robbed for 42 cents, actually. That was all that he had in his pocket.
Shot and mugged is what I read.
Shot. Yeah. Shot in the stomach. And he was in a coma for about 6 weeks. And while he was in that coma, he believes, he remembers that he visited all these distant places, sort of astral projection kind of thing. And the faces that came to him were of Egyptian pharaohs. And so when he...
He did the brushes, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the work ended up looking like the Egyptian pharaohs that he would create. In the beginning, he was using... Well, first he created in stone. He was carving in stone. So he was carving a lot of signs and things with people's names and cubs and things like that because he lived right near Cubs Park. But then when he started working with bottle caps and brushes and that sort of thing, he'd take used paint brushes and old the brooms. I don't understand this part, but the brooms that they used to use to put the tar on the roof of buildings, they would use these brooms, and then they would be all, you know, frozen into that position with the tar, and that would become the hair or the headdress of these figures that he would use plastic wood that he would shape a face onto the brush, and then he would paint on eyes, and, you know, he would build a nose and stuff, and then he would dress it up with beads and jewelry and glitter and paint. They were very, very nice. And all, then what happened for me is I started noticing that they looked like him. Yeah. They looked like Mr. Imagination. His real name was Gregory Warmack.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and he died May 30th, 2012. Mm-hmm. So he had a pretty fascinating life.
Our music fans will know. I mean, he did the bar with bottle caps at the House of Blues.
That's the House of Blues, that's
there.
Right.
Yeah, he was very, got involved in bottle caps there for a while. And, what else? Well, yeah, I want to know what else are people going to be able to see in the exhibit? What of your stuff will he have?
Well, it's going to be a lot of the work that he created that is not so much, you know, it's like some of it's furniture. He made giant totems that are 6 to 8 feet tall.
We've got a throne that he created, and he has that Egyptian cobra head on the back of the throne made out of bottle caps. But the chair itself, I mean, it's a chair, but it's like a giant throne. And then there are faces on the front of it that look like his face.
Yeah.
So we have an enormous number of pieces. People are going to be able to see, you know, a whole
range
of the kinds of things he was interested in over the course of his life.
He was a major figure in this genre. I mean, Coca-Cola, I remember being at the Olympics in 96. Didn't they commission him to do a big bottle?
Yes, he did an absolute bottle. And he did a lot of different commissions. He did one at the Elliott Nannerley Youth Center right here in Chicago. Right. That was his first commission. He also did something in Orlando. He did a grotto in Milwaukee.
Is there one in Bronzeville? I think there's one here.
I think that's Elliott.
Yeah.
But that goes into what we're talking about. We got a few minutes left. But, I mean, he really did love working with kids and reach out with kids and stuff. Can you talk about what kids – will this be a big exhibit with kids and families?
I think it's going to be really accessible for families.
Yeah.
So I would say if anyone's been thinking about bringing their young people over, bring them over. And our Intua Teens, which is our youth group, are going to be doing bottle cap art on some of the days when people come in. So they take bottle caps and help families and kids make – wearable art like brooches, pins that they can pin on with found objects. So just like Mr. Imagination, they'll have an opportunity to create something.
I remember going to visit him over by Wrigley.
And
he would give you that little necklace with the eye
when you visited him. Right,
it was made out of sandstone or something. Yeah.
And he would paint it white. And that was when he would say the eye stands for imagination.
Yeah, yeah.
It was an eye. Not the letter I.
He had such a tough, he had a lot of bad breaks, but he was such a, just a warm soul, you know.
Yeah.
He really did.
He was a warm soul. And and speaking of innocence, you know, that word again, he just didn't seem to have an agenda. He was, what you saw was what you got with him. He was, didn't have any guile. He was just a sweet person. And I think that's what children saw in him.
Yeah.
Because whenever he would be around kids. They would follow him like he was the Pied Piper.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So let's get the details. I got the 6 to 9 on the 9th is the opening. Tell the exhibit how long it's going to run, when people can come see it.
We're going to be opening it this coming Friday night, March 9th.
January
9th.
Sorry, yes. what year are we in now? January 9th. We'll be open 5 to 8 p.m. It's free this Friday night. We'll be there on Saturday as well, of course. And the curator, Martha Henry, is going to be doing a presentation at 2 p.m. on Saturday. And then the show's going to run until April 25th. We're open Tuesday through Saturday. Usually we're open 11 to 6, but on Thursday nights we're open late. Come see us. This is a great show for anyone who wants to discover their own inner creativity. They can either relate to Mr. I's work, or we'll have some teens on hand to help them roll up their sleeves and actually get creative. Anyone can create.
His spirit will be there. I know.
Absolutely.
That. Yeah. Thanks, you guys, for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks,
good,
Dave.
Good luck with everything.
All right.
Okay?
Thank you.
All right, thanks. We'll be back with John Langford and Nan Warshaw from Bloodshot Records after the news. Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. I'm Dave Hoekstra, and we're here with Nan Warshaw and Johnny Langford to celebrate 20 years of Bloodshot Records. How are you guys?
Great. Thanks for having us.
Thanks
Fantastic.
For coming in. Thanks for coming in, John.
Good to see you on the radio, Dave.
It's a good place for me.
Yeah, it's great.
So tell us about Bloodshot, assuming anybody listening may not know nothing about it. So tell us a little bit of the early history of Bloodshot and how it all started.
Well, Bloodshot is an indie label based in Chicago. And 20 years ago, it was just a harebrained idea to put together a compilation about Chicago bands that all were playing in the underground rock clubs and around town, but they all had some thread of American roots forms running through their music. And so we came up with this idea for a compilation, put it out, and it was called For a Life of Sin, Insurgent Chicago Country. And that was the beginning. And it was really just a snapshot of the scene at the time. And then when that record, you know, when we sold 1,000 copies and broke even, we said, hey, we can do another record. And it went on from there.
Now, I can't remember 20 years ago, but was it like Urge Overkill, Liz Phair? What was going on in the rock world, and how did that kind of...
It was Urge Overkill, yeah. Liz Phair.
Yeah. Was it really?
Yeah, both those things were going on.
I mean, because there was a lot of press about all that. That was a big deal.
And Chicago was ground zero at the time for that. And you know, we'd grown up on punk rock, and it had been co-opted by the major labels. And so we were looking for, personally, just seeking something that spoke to us and that was still underground and, you know, a place where I could jump in the pit and not get hurt because I knew everyone else who was in there dancing with me.
I moved you to the States in 92.
92.
From South Wales.
Right.
Because I am from the South. And I came here looking for, you know, my imagined version of American country music, and it didn't exist.
Nothing.
Well, I've turned on the radio, there was all this kind of cowboy hat kind of suburban pop music going on. It was called country music, but there was no Hank Williams, Bob Wills, Johnny Cash, or anything that even sounded like that in the 90s.
Well, my theory, I've written this, and this is just me. I don't know if anybody agrees with me, but I always look at the Sundowners as kind of a jump on. You guys would go down there and see those guys at the old Double R. I mean,
when the Mekons first came to town, people would, so you've got to come out after the show, and we'll take you and see we'll take you down to the Double R Ranch on, where was that, on Randolph Street?
Yeah, it was right by the Greyhound bus station.
Right, yeah. we went in. Underneath, yeah, it was like subterranean. It was really dark and scary. And the first time we went in, they got us up to sing some songs because we'd been to Alcala's in the afternoon, and we looked like a country band, although we weren't. So they got us up to play on like a Saturday night in front of a bunch of drunk Chicagoans, and we were horrible. So I decided I'd come back and be good the next time.
And that had to be like the late 80s, right, maybe?
That was like 87, yeah, 88. Yeah, yeah. But we came back every year. Every time we came to town, we'd hang out with them and play some songs with them. And that was my kind of initiation.
That was important. And then, you know, those guys, I mean, they had so many, they played a lot of different types of music. I mean,
they played country and Western.
Yeah.
You know? Both types of music.
Yeah, right.
They played both.
But they covered everything from Beatles songs, you know, to the classic country.
Yeah. So how'd you two meet? How'd you guys hook up?
I think it was in the Empty Bottle. And didn't the two people you were trying to start a label with said, go and talk to him. That's John Langford. And so when you said, why don't you go and talk to him? But,
yeah. Rob and Eric, my partners at the time, were too afraid to go talk to John because they were such huge meek. They were such huge meek on bands. They were intimidated, and so they just pushed me forward. And I was like, "Oh, sure, I'll go say hello and ask if John had give us a track for this compilation we were doing." And then the song he ended up giving us, and I remember going to your apartment back in Bucktown, I think it was. And you guys were rehearsing, you and Tom Ray and Steve Goulding, and you gave it to me on a cassette. And I don't know, I doubt that was a master, but that's what you gave me to listen to. And I took it back to the office and we listened, and I think we all had like tears in our eyes. It was so perfect. And that's when Rob said, John knows what Bloodshot's about better than we do.
Yeah, and then how do you start? Okay. I mean, how did you guys, were there a delegation of duties? Did someone take care of talent? Did someone take care of budget? I mean, did everybody do everything?
It was very organic. Yeah. We all did what we could, whoever could do it best did it. And it's evolved and remains that way. And the way our staff divide up duties is who's interested and who has the time to do it and the ability.
Who were some of the, go ahead.
Well, so what was interesting about Bloodshot in the very first instance, I think, was they were trying to catalog a scene that possibly existed in Chicago, which I might have been a part of, but I didn't even really know was going on. But there was a lot of people who were disillusioned with the way country music had gone and were very interested in the classic country music and interested in tinkering with that. And there was a scene in Chicago, so they put this record out. And that record came out, and then all over the country, every other city had little scenes of the same sort of thing going on simultaneously. It wasn't like somebody had one bright idea, but I think Bloodshot kind of got in there first, really, didn't you? And then there was all these people.
Yeah, we started getting letters and faxes, literally. That was before email, from all over the country, from Dallas and San Francisco and New York City.
What about Nashville?
Some from Nashville, too. Yeah, and in fact, we put out a compilation of Nashville bands as well.
Yeah.
And it's called The Other
Side of the Alley.
Yeah.
Now, how do you feel how things have grown in the climate? I mean, Americana, they have a conference every year. I think Americana's got the whole thing has got a little corporate and stuff. How have you guys kept your own path?
Well, I don't know that we were ever the center of Americana. We've always kind of been the red-haired stepchild. But, you know, we've just worked with artists we love and music that was interesting and different and new and people who could bring styles together in new ways. And so it really doesn't matter if, there wasn't critical language when we started for all this. And so it's nice that there is today more so. But, you know, then again, that's pigeonholing things if you try and shove any of our artists into strictly an Americana category.
Yeah. I don't want to single someone up, but how do you find someone like Lydia Lovelace? Does someone like that come to you? Do you find them or?
You know, there's a variety of ways. Our best source is our artists who are out there hard touring, and they say, hey, this band played the show with us, and they're really great. You should check them out. But from a number of trusted sources, journalists, other just friends. And we read, you know, reviews of great shows or of records. And so a variety of places.
For both of you, what do you know now that you didn't know then?
I don't know. I think I probably knew it then, but I didn't. I think you just sort of stick to what makes sense and what feels honest to you to do. And I think that's what Bloodshot have done. And it started off with quite a small umbrella of, you know, there was a certain sound that was almost a Bloodshot sound, and certain bands had a kind of, you know, you could tell what was a Bloodshot band and what wasn't. And now I think Bloodshot, you know, by sticking true to their roots, have expanded that they, you know, they've found different ways to incorporate all sorts of different types of music that still has the same kind of maybe ethical kind of direction or kind of, you know, it's more of an attitude thing, maybe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, John, I think that's your fault being our role model.
No, don't take me for a role model.
Really, I think that, you know, Chicago was a great place for Bloodshot to start because of the cross-pollination between artists and the support within the music community. So many great clubs with live music of all genres every night of the year, and then a lot of fantastic writers in town and great radio. And so Chicago has been a perfect place for Bloodshot to grow, maybe the only place we ever could have developed. But, you know, what do we know today? I mean, so many details I couldn't even begin to say, but I will say that, you know, it's been great to have a hobby that could turn into a business. And really, you know, John Lankford and the Mekons and Pine Valley Cosmonauts and Waco Brothers were all a great example of how you can, you know, make great art on your own terms, and you don't have to, you know, compromise your ethics just to work within the music business.
The turn of what's it been like to work with veteran artists? I mean, you've worked with Graham Parker, Alejandro, and stuff. What's that been like?
It's an honor. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, I couldn't ask for anything better than to work with some of our heroes. And you know, we put out the Bloodshot Revival series as well, and got to meet Hank Thompson. And, you know, working with the Sundowners, and it's incredible to be part of that legacy. And Roger Knox.
Roger Knox, yeah.
Who John produced a record and performed on it and is going
Aboriginal
back to...
Aboriginal country and Western music. Yeah. I got to go to the Sydney Festival next week. He's headlining the Sydney Festival on the closing night.
Really?
And they're paying for me to go over and stand next to him, strumming an acoustic guitar and singing lamely along with him as producer of the record. Great.
So now what's going to go on next Saturday night at Metro? It's the 20th anniversary?
Yeah, so on Saturday... January 10th at Metro, we have a big Bloodshot 20th anniversary show with Ben Queller, Lydia Lovelace, Bobby Bear Jr., Bandidos, and then the new special guest is Rhett Miller, who was just added to the bill. And then there's a couple more special guests who haven't been announced yet.
And what time does that start? Did I see 6:30?
Doors are at 6:30, yeah. And right before that, we have a pre-party at the Ginger Man next door with Yard Dog Gallery, where they're going to be showing artwork. It's an art opening at 5 o'clock, and that's free and open to the public.
And John, tell us about your thing with Yard Dog. You work with them, right?
Yeah.
In Austin, Texas?
I thought the first time I met the Yard Dog people was we went down in 96, was it? We had a party in the backyard outside this little folk art gallery just up the hill on South Congress.
Austin, Texas, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the bill was, it was the No Depression Bloodshot Party, and it was the old 97s Whiskey Town and the Waco Brothers.
I think that was 94?
No.
No, 95.
I think it was 96.
Okay.
I bet you it was 96.
Okay.
I'll wrestle you. No.
And so people may not know you're an artist as well. People not you know, just tuning in for the first time.
I've done a bunch of artwork for Bloodshot. That's how I really kind of got, you know, back into it, through our mutual friend Tony Fitzpatrick and his World Tattoo Gallery.
Yeah, right.
I've done a lot of artwork over the years, but mainly I was a musician.
And you've got a lot of stuff coming up, just looking at my notes. And I mean, you got to tell us about your, you got an art show tomorrow, right? John Langford Open Studio.
Oh, a little open studio tomorrow, yeah.
And where's that at?
That's at my studio.
2630 West Fletcher?
Yeah.
Open to the public?
Yeah.
And what will be there?
I don't mind if the public want to turn up.
And what will be there for that?
We got some nice pictures that I did on the walls. And then, I do that every year, and I was meant to do it last week, but I had to go to England. So I'm doing it this week. It's meant to be a Christmas sale.
Okay.
You know? So this is for everyone to come and get their Christmas presents for next year.
And then I'm real interested in this. You've got another, you're involved with the Country Music Hall of Fame upcoming exhibit.
Yeah, that's been really quite remarkable, actually, because they got in touch with me to do a painting for an exhibition that they're working on called Dylan Cash and the Nashville Cats. And it's kind of a really in-depth, very scholarly kind of like exhibit that they're going to do about that crazy period in time. I think they're trying to debunk the kind of hippie versus redneck myth of the 60s, you know, the Merle Haggard, Okie from Muskogee, like how there was rednecks on one side and hippies on the other side. And what really was going on, Dylan went there in 66, I think,
right,
and recorded three albums that year and took all these other people. And Nashville was actually kind of the hub of rock and roll at that point in the mid-60s, and people don't really know that. So
opens March 27th.
Yeah, and they kind of gave me the keys to the kingdom, so I'm going to go down and have an art show to go along with that exhibit and play some gigs down in the Hall of Fame. So.
We're going to take a break. Would you do a song for us when we come back?
I might.
Okay. All right. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. I'm Dave Hoekstra. We're here with Nan Morshaw and John Langford talking about the greatness of Bloodshot Records. That's Lydia Lovelace. We keep talking about Lydia Lovelace.
Yes, that is.
Yeah.
And she'll be at Metro on next Saturday on January 10th for the big Bloodshot show. And you can find out more about that at bloodshotrecords.com.
She's an Ohio woman, right?
Yes, she is.
Yeah, yeah. Is she from Columbus?
Columbus area, yeah. A little farm town outside of Columbus.
That's great. That's great. Okay. John, you're going to do a song?
I'll do your song. I'll do some in there. Was this on a Bloodshot record? Of course it was. Yeah, I'll do this one. It's this was on an album called All the Fame of Lofty Deeds. Must Perish Like a Dream. Drinking pills in Nashville, radio life will never be the same. Chills and spills from Maine to Mexico, riding on my funeral train. In every town there's the same tribulation, every state I wake up in. The night before was a dim recollection of powders and bottles and sin. As a body of a stranger heading out the door, just about half my age. Blood on the walls, glass on the floor, I don't think I even made it on stage. I said, doctor, doctor, sign my prescription, I'm in trouble again. Ever since I was a tiny little baby, I couldn't get rid of the pain. Shake my hips, but I walk like a cripple and my body is getting too thin. I can count every one of my bones in the mirror, poking through my cold white skin. There's a shiny star on the dressing room door, but I'll be out in the back of my car. Cause I don't know a soul I can trust with the money or to tune up my guitar. Drinking pills in Nashville, radio life will never be the same. Chills and spills from Maine to Mexico, riding on my funeral train. Can't sleep without the engine humming, wheels rolling night and day. Well, I can't sleep without Nashville radio slipping through my chemical haze. Playing some song that I don't remember with a DJ calling my name. If they play my songs on the Nashville radio, life will never be the same. I said, doctor, doctor, sign my prescription, I'm in trouble again. Ever since I was a tiny little baby, I couldn't get rid of the pain.
ever since I was a tiny little baby. I couldn't get to sleep at night, listening to that Nashville radio hours before daylight. They threw me off the Grand Ole Opry, cause I couldn't behave. Never knew how many friends I had till I was lying in a cold, damp grave. I gave my life to country music, took my pills and lost. They don't play my songs on the radio, it's like I never was. Fat sweaty cop in an Alabama lockup, he looked at me and he laughed. Heard my songs on the Nashville radio, he asked me for my autograph. He said, doctor, doctor, sign my prescription, I'm in trouble again. Ever since I was a tiny little baby, I couldn't get rid of the pain. Drinking pills and Nashville radio, life will never be the same. Chills and spills from Maine to Mexico, riding on my funeral train.
Wow, very good, very good. Very good.
I haven't attempted to sing in a while.
Not dedicated to little Jimmy Dickens either. That's right.
No. Yeah.
Now, when did you write that?
That song, I don't know. It was kind of during the Waco Brothers, sort of like early period. And I think the Wacos went, no, that's way too country. We don't want to do that.
You liked Johnny Cash when you were a kid, right? I mean,
I didn't really realize he was country and western. I thought he was like Elvis, like rock and roll or something. But he had big, big hits in Britain, Boy Named Sue, and then the whole kind of Granada TV, Folsom Prison. San Quentin.
San Quentin.
It was a Manchester TV documentary, so I saw that when I was a kid. But I just thought he was like, I didn't really realize he was country music because he was interesting, and I thought country music was boring.
I'm fascinated with the label. I mean, so you don't, Nashville's kind of, I mean, Nashville's always perceived as this big machine, but have you just ignored it, or how do you relate to Nashville as opposed to what you're trying to do with country music?
Well, commercial country and what passes for country music on commercial country radio, you know, doesn't have a lot to do with us. It's a tradition of country music and, you know, the great country songs and forms historically that I think are, you know, what our artists are drawn to. And, I mean, we were pretty oblivious to what was on commercial country radio when we started the label. And today, you know, and our bands have always gotten played on, you know, non-commercial radio and college radio and public radio and, you know, in variety shows like this and not on country radio. And so it's an odd relationship because we really, you know, don't partake in it, I guess.
It's weird. Well, go ahead.
Sorry, go on. I met Johnny Cash in 1987, in Manchester, and he said he couldn't get on country radio.
Yeah, right.
What I mean? They'd stopped playing it. By then, they'd stopped playing
it. About the time I went to the House of Cash to see him. I think he was on Mercury or something then. Yeah,
Columbia had fired him. Yeah, he ended up on Mercury Records. It's just, I mean, I was horrified. When I moved here, or when I came over here, I thought it was going to be, you know, America had this huge explosion in the 20th century, this most amazing music anyone's ever thought of or heard of, and country music, blues music, and it had all been like kind of completely commodified and stuck into little boxes, and like Nashville's the country town, Chicago's the blues town.
Yeah.
You know, and then Chicago's got this huge tradition of country music. Nashville's got this tradition of black music, which is really amazing. Right. People like the simplest story and they swallow it, and it's really sad. And I think that's what Bloodshot's been about. It's been, for me anyway, it's just sort of like getting to the weirdness and the brilliance of it all. And
maybe we can pick this up after the news, but that's why I keep going back to, we'll do this right after the news. I want to ask you about a new Music City, maybe do one more song. And okay, all right, we'll be right back after the news.
Dollar green, dollar.
Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. I'm Dave Hoekstra, and we're here with John Lankford, Nan Warshaw, Bloodshot Records. Tell us about that track that's from your 20th anniversary project.
Right.
It's not a tribute record, really, is it?
No, it's not. Yeah. It's, that's Andrew Bird and Nora O'Connor covering a song by Robbie Folk's song. And so what this compilation, which is titled While No One Was Looking, Toasting 20 Years of Bloodshot Records, what it's about is 38 different tracks where all sorts of artists covered their favorite songs from the Bloodshot catalog. And so it's a huge variety of artists from Blitz and Trapper, Chris Shiflett, Minus Five.
Diarrhea Planet covered the Waco Brothers.
Who are they?
They're huge, apparently. No. They're really good as well.
Where are they from?
Where are Diarrhea Planet from? I would hate to say
that. I'll have to research that.
Where okay. They're from Diarrhea Planet.
Or Bloomington?
Bloomington? Okay.
Maybe. Something like that.
Okay.
Sorry.
They're popular and they're young.
Yeah. Okay. What they song are. Did they cover? I didn't know.
What's it called?
Dry Land.
Dry Land.
Good one for them.
Yeah. It's great. It's really amazing. Actually, it was beautiful because it's like that Dean. That's more of a Dean song for the Wiggles. But there's three of my songs done by various different people. And it's incredibly flattering and exciting to hear them.
Yeah. Chuck Prophet covered Andre Williams, right?
Yes.
Tell us who Andre Williams is, and I want to make that point before I let you go about you guys do more than country music.
Absolutely. Our bands use all sorts of American roots forms that they bring into their music in all different ways. And so Andre Williams is a classic old school R&B performer, and he worked with some of the greats. He was a producer with Ike on some Ike Turner records.
Yeah. He was at Motown, you know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and so we've been working with him for years now, and he is still prolific, still, you know, looking to perform. He's in his 70s and still performing. And just a pleasure to work with, a serious character who's lived a hard life and writes great songs.
Okay. And tell us again, before we let you go, the show next Saturday night at Metro.
Yes, the show at Metro is on Saturday, January 10th. Tickets are $21, and you can get them at metrochicago.com. And more information at bloodshotrecords.com. And that show features Ben Queller, Lydia Loveless, Rhett Miller from the old 97s, Bandidos, and Bobby Bear Jr., plus some other special guests.
And the Ginger Man thing, the pre-show. I used to think the Ginger Man had the best Bloody Marys in the city. I haven't had one in a long time there, but they were very good.
They used to have one opening day every year.
Yeah, they're really good.
Yeah.
And that's a pre-show. So, can you do a song to sign us up? You know, send us
yeah,
off?
I'll do a Waco Brothers
okay,
song.
Okay.
Ooh, bang, crash.
I'm really curious. This whole. Did you ever hear the story that Dylan has your artwork on his bus? Someone told me that.
Nick Tremulous.
Yeah, someone else told me that.
Yeah, because.
But nobody's allowed to go on Dylan's bus.
Because he asked the bass player if he'd seen it, because Charlie. What's his name, the guitar player?
Charlie Sexton.
Yeah, he bought it from Yard Dog and gave it to Bob Dylan. Apparently, it's on the bus.
But no one's allowed
and
to go on the
bus. Said, have you seen Langford's artworks on the bus? And the bass player, what's his name? I can't remember anybody's name.
Tony something?
Tony Garnier.
Yeah, Garnier.
Yeah, that guy, you're good.
Yeah.
And he said, how would I have seen it? I've never been on his bus.
Yeah. But, so thanks for coming in. Send us out. Okay.
Well, good to hear you on the radio.
Okay, thanks, John.
His study is written by the winner. This is a loser song. I took this job in the summer. Never saw the winter rolling on. I never thought it would end in a second. A burnout smoking wreck. Expectations and ambition. Just a rope around my neck. Broke my back to and across. Saw my dreams die in the dust. Now I'm walking on hell's roof looking at the flowers. Walking on hell's roof looking at the flowers. All in bloom. Red, yellow, nothing better to do. Well, I'm not hiding, come and find me. What am I doing? There's no need to remind me. Walking on hell's roof, looking at the flowers. In the A to B and the miles per hour. While keeping out of reach of a higher power. Where the bees are buzzing in the April showers. The spoils belong to the victor. This is a consolation song. Your life is science fiction. In a flash, then you'll be gone. No more trials and no more troubles. Bad luck and bursting bubbles. Walking on hell's roof, looking at the flowers. Yeah, we've been walking on hell's roof, looking at the flowers. Nan Washer on bongos.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thanks for coming in. We're going to have Nick Russo in a minute. We're going to take a break here, and we'll be back with Nick Russo and some Jilly's memories. Thanks for listening.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Before we get Spanish, we'll make the town roar. We'll make all the late spots and then a few more.
We'll start in at Jilly's and maybe Toots Shore.
Life is gonna be a wee-wow-wee.
Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. I'm Dave Hoekstra, and we're here with Nick Russo, my favorite piano player in the city. Johnny Langford's going to sit in. My dream is to get them to do a song together. We'll see what happens. But Nick, how you been?
I've been good. Real good, Dave.
Now, that's a Jilly's tune. I know you from Jilly's.
Yes.
So again, tell everybody what Jilly's was. And Jilly was a... Jilly Rizzo was a friend of Sinatra's bodyguard.
Yes, Jilly Rizzo was Sinatra's best friend for decades of years, and he was his bodyguard, his right hand man. He was with him at all times. A lot of the on the main event, when you see the beginning of the main event starting, you see Jilly right at his side. And Jilly's on Rush Street opened up in May of '95, and it was just. We never dreamed it would take off like it did. There were lines, blocks and blocks to get in, and it just was the place to be. Just music, people-wise, just the place to be.
95 to 2003 is about the rough run of it?
That was the heyday, it closed in 2012.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right.
And how'd you get involved? How'd you get to be the piano player there?
Some of the people that were founding Jilly's, the one man, Stan Wozniak, was a manager at the Red Hat, and I currently was playing at the Red Hat, and he had asked me, I'm going to be leaving to open up Jilly's, and we'd like you to come with us. And then I also was familiar with the investors that were starting Jilly's. I had known them for years as customers, and one thing led to another, and there I was. I was the piano player at Jilly's.
John, I know you're a busy guy. Didn't I see you at the Redhead one night? Redhead Piano Bar?
Yes. I used to go in there.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I've been to Jilly's, but I've never been to the Redhead.
You haven't been there? How did you see me in there then? just your spies saw me in there. I've been in there.
So what was the difference between playing the Redhead and Jilly's? Was there...
Well, when I was at the Redhead, we did a lot of the same music that we wound up doing at Jilly's. It was all Sinatra due to the manager who was there. That's how he wanted the Redhead to go. Then when we both left and opened up Jilly's, the Redhead seemed to go a different way because they didn't want to do what we were doing. And that was understandable. So they went more of a Billy Joel type music, which is all good. You know, we need a little bit of everything to make the world go round. I've always been a believer of that. But then Jilly's became all Rat Pack music. Bobby Darin, Sinatra, big band. That's the kind of stuff I did. There was dancing. They danced.
Yeah.
They danced anywhere they could find a spot. They danced.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Now, I'm always intrigued by the people who came in there. Tell us, I've got three celebrity people I want to go through.
Go ahead.
Ozzy Osbourne coming to Jilly's.
Well, I didn't even know what was going on. I mean, he came in a few nights in a row. I guess he was in town. And he was watching me and And then it came out, I guess it came out in your article, that he was really impressed, and it was, you know, different for him. It was different for me, you know, and he turned out to be a real nice guy, you know.
But he didn't play or anything. Did he tell me once he just sat there and watched you
just
play?
Just watched, yeah. And he would nod his head to me like as an approval type thing, and I would nod back. And then I did real long sets there, so by the time I took a break, sometimes he'd be gone.
Did you know it was him?
Oh, yeah, I knew it was him, like, after the second.
But he wasn't, did he dress, how was he dressed?
His hair gave it away.
Yeah. He was chewing on a bat.
He just, if it wasn't him, it was a biker or something, you know, but it was him. You know,
there was not a big dress code at Jilly's.
No, not really. Yeah, not really. We had all kinds.
And Tom Jones?
Tom Jones.
Yeah. What was that like?
That was something else, because he sang that night and did not sing one of his own songs. He sang all Sinatra songs. He wanted to sing Sinatra songs. Wow. And that floored everybody around.
I saw him at a festival in Scotland in the summer in Inverness, and he headlined this Friday night, and he did three of his hits.
Yeah.
And the rest of the stuff he did, like Howlin' Wolf stuff, he's still a great singer.
Oh yeah, oh my God, that had to be in the late 90s after we were open maybe 1 or 2 years when that happened. And he floored everybody, all the employees. Everybody was speechless. You know?
Did they throw underwear at you?
No.
No?
No, never. They didn't throw it at him or me. No.
Really?
No.
You must have been off duty then.
No, they didn't do that. But he was an experience. And then, you know, he had a ball, and I guess there was – he sent a letter afterwards a couple of weeks later and said what a great time he had. He sent it upstairs, you know, and it was really nice, you know, another bit of memorabilia that I have. And I have tons of memories.
And the last one, Billy Joel.
Billy Joel. It's a real funny story. He came in on a Saturday night, and I had started at 9 o'clock, and it must have been about 20 after 9. And the manager of Jilly's looks at me down the aisle. I could see him. It still wasn't overly packed yet because we had just opened. And he gives me a motion with his hand, like, to get up. He goes, like, you know, with his thumb, like, to, you know, get up off your chair. And I looked at him and motioned with my mouth, like, what do you mean? I just started playing. And he stepped aside, and there was Billy Joel. And I couldn't see Billy Joel the first time. But then I saw him, and I looked at the manager, and I says, I understand. And I got up. Billy Joel crossed in front of me, sat down at the piano, sang One for My Baby, sang it like you've never heard, got up, patted me on the chest as he was leaving, and goes, you're doing a fine job, big guy. And I went, I could almost, like, hardly not answer. And he left the building, and the flash cubes went off, and there it was. And another one that it seemed like everybody who came in, they didn't do their own music. They wanted to do a Sinatra song at Jilly's. That was their thrill, and it was a thrill for us.
And what was your run there? How long did it turn out
to be 18 years.
18 years.
Yes. 18 years. The longest job I've ever had. I've been in the Chicago area, you know.
Yeah. You brought all this. Tell us what all you brought, and I'm asking you. You told me one time you played Fly Me to the Moon like 8 times a night.
Yes, and now still, at once for sure, maybe twice, any night that I work. Yes, it's still the most requested Sinatra song.
And what all did you bring? Tell me about the
I brought my 88 note keyboard, a digital keyboard, and I use an iPad now, and on the iPad I have bass and drums, and I have arrangements that I did myself, and the way according to how I've arranged the chord changes on the iPad, that's what the iPad tells the bass to play. And it comes out, and it sounds like a nice trio, and I'm getting that nice sound. And then depending on the system I have when I perform live, the better the system, the more it sounds real, more real and more real.
Now, can you play? Can you play Fly Me to the Moon?
I can play it right now.
Okay.
Now?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song. Let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
Very, very nice.
Hey.
Well, Jack Daniels there. Very, very smooth vocals.
Thank you.
I was going to ask you, I've talked to you before, but what was your introduction to music? I mean, was it music around the house? What made you want to become a piano player?
I started when I was 7 years old. It came to my grammar school with 6 free weeks of accordion lessons.
where was that? Where was your grammar school at?
I went to grammar school on Addison Street in the city, St. Vitus.
Okay. All right.
I was off of Addison and Pulaski. And I did the 6 free weeks, kept on going, wound up going to DePaul University for music and got hooked up with all the local musicians in the city and had trios, quartets, and then I went alone in 1979, and I've been a single since then.
1979, piano.
1979, I went alone piano. As a single, you know, a single act.
And what was your first gig at?
As a single is where now the Rosemont Theater is. It used to be the Caravelle Motel and
restaurant.
Oh, my
gosh.
Restaurant.
Wow.
In Rosemont. And that's the same ground where they built the Rosemont Theater.
What kind of room was that?
We went to see Merle Haggard then.
Yeah, we did.
We
did. Remember that? Yeah, yeah.
It was our big night.
We had good seats, yeah.
It was nice. It was a big dining room, a small lounge area where I was, and it was connected to the motel, and, you know, they had rooms. It was nice. It was a nice place at the time, you know. Like I said, it was 79.
And how's the landscape changed? I mean, as far as finding work and stuff. I mean, the piano bars. I mean, how many are still up? Zebra Lounge. I mean, how many are still around?
A lot are gone.
Yeah.
Yes. It's not as, not quite as easy as it used to be. They're there, but thank God in my case, I have a little bit of a following and the time that I put in. They know who my name is. But if you were, I pity the young kids coming up now at 20 years old and breaking into it because are there still
people, young people following that path?
That I'm not sure. I always thought there'd be somebody chasing me when I got older, and it hasn't happened. But I guess that's a good thing for me.
Yeah,
I got a couple of years left there, Dave.
What do you got coming up?
Well, this past December 12th, I did a real nice show at the Arcata Theater in St. Charles with Ron Onesti, and it was myself and 7 singers and a 9-piece band. We did 99th Sinatra birthday party, and it was sold out. It was wonderful. We got real good reviews from it. We're going to be doing that throughout the year a few more times, and then it's going to culminate this December 12th. It'll be his 100th birthday party. It'll be on a bigger scale, bigger band, maybe a bigger show, and that we're sort of don't know all the details yet.
Okay. We're going to take a break for the news. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about the drummer for that gig.
Sure.
We have some more questions after this. We'll be right back.
I saw the light on the night that I passed by her window. I saw the flickering shadows of love on her blind.
I love it. Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. I'm Dave Hoekstra here with Nick Russo and John Langford. Delilah, tell us what that song means.
That's the
means.
Welsh National Anthem.
Yeah.
You know?
Tell us about that. I was just reading about that over the weekend.
It's a vicious murder ballad that my grandmother used to make me sing to her when I was about 9 years old at Christmas. It's a savage, brutal song about a guy killing his girlfriend.
How did it become?
Apparently, but you never know what happens because she laughs no more. You know, maybe, I don't know, maybe he just cuts out a sense of humor or something. You know?
And I just read over the weekend or something that, is there a controversy with the rugby team or the soccer team? They sing it during the matches?
They sing it at every Welsh rugby match. Yeah, it's like a folk song. It's like a brilliant, you know, big deal.
But they don't want him to sing it anymore, right? Because it's so violent.
They're going to stop them. Like on a rugby match. Yeah. Rugby's not exactly a non-violent sport. You know? It's a fantastic song. If my grandmother liked it, it's all right for the Welsh rugby team to hear it. That's ridiculous. Political correctness gone mad, Dave.
Yeah. But Tom Jones never did Delilah when he came into Jilly's.
No, he didn't do it at Jilly's. Yeah.
So tell us the story when you were doing the gig and who the drummer was and the relation with Buddy Rich.
Yeah, on this last show that we did at the Arcata Theater, we had a 9-piece band, and the drummer happens to be dating Buddy Rich's daughter, Kathy Rich, I believe her name is, and his name was Greg Potter. And he had the Buddy Rich logo on the front of his drum, on his bass drum.
And that's
like Buddy Rich. I mean, my God. And then if you looked up into the right, there was a signature. It was signed by Buddy Rich. And Dave, I swear to God, this kid started to play. I call him a kid. I don't know. He might have been in his late 20s, early 30s. He played like Buddy Rich. I mean, the closest I've ever seen. He was great, just great.
All the mannerisms?
The mannerisms, hit the cymbal above and below and did rolls. Exactly. I was like, wow.
What was the transition like for you when you left the band and went to a solo act and you didn't have the band ambiance?
Yeah, well, in 79 it was a little harder because they didn't have all these things invented yet. You know, I started off with just an electronic keyboard, sometimes a real keyboard, a real piano, and a drum machine, which was barely, you could use the word drum machine. It was pitiful now that you look back on it. But then it was all there was to have. And it gave a little bit of a beat, and it created the mood for the people to dance. And it got me through. And then every year, things got better and better with the invention of things. And then it was a lot easier to be a single, you know. And now it's, with this iPad, it's fun. It's actually fun.
And people can see you in Schaumburg?
Every Thursday. I've been there since June. I'm at a restaurant called Zeal, 680 North Mall Drive in Schaumburg. And I'm there every Thursday. And wonderful food and, of course, the kind of good music.
And how much is it, that stuff you just pick, and how much you take requests? I mean, is there a proportion? Is there a percentage of?
When I sit at a piano bar atmosphere, the requests are heavy, lot of them. When I'm on a small stage, less. It's some reason or other, it feels like people may be intimidated to walk up to me on the stage.
Like a Waco Brothers show.
Yeah.
Be careful, get your teeth kicked in.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. What's the biggest tip you've ever gotten?
Don't go out in the rain without an umbrella.
Oh, that's a lot.
I don't know. I mean, I've gotten weird things. I'll tell you. I got it at Jilly's. On a napkin, somebody did a caricature of me playing the piano. It was suitable for framing. That was probably one of the best tips I ever got.
Do people raise?
My wife and me still have it somewhere.
Do people like put money in for tips higher and higher and higher, so you play the song and stuff?
No, I don't. I don't really get that. I don't get.
No, you swap to the Sundowners.
Yeah.
That's another Waco kind of thing.
Yeah.
No. The Danny Hour and our ranch. They used to put the cat. There was Joan Delaney told me about. You know, Kurt Delaney's wife told me about this. The cattle ranchers came in. It was a convention or something, and they made them play some song over and over again. And every time they played it, they gave them like they upped the money. So they all each came home with about $3,000 in like '50s, like kind of a wild night.
There was something Chicago. Like that. Wasn't there an Entwistle story like that too? And Entwistle like paid him a lot of money for to hear one song or something.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. But I don't remember that. So you guys are going to do a song together. I'm really thrilled.
We're going to try.
Yeah.
This is a Dave Hoekstra production.
Yes. If it doesn't go good, it's on you.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Okay. All right. This is because John and I are both in Chicago now. All right, here we go, John. Come on. Baby, don't you want to go? Come on, baby, don't you wanna go?
to that same old place, sweet old Chicago. Now, 1 and 1 is 2, 6 and 2 is 8. Come on, baby, don't be late. Come on, baby, don't you wanna go back to that same old place, sweet home Chicago. Back to that same old place, sweet home Chicago.
Excellent.
Just like we rehearsed.
Yeah.
Right.
You got a new sound. Paging Nan Warshaw. You got a. That's great. That's great.
That was for you, mate. Nobody else.
Thank you. You know, I always wondered about like maybe doing a piano bar album. You know, I mean, Buddy Charles has passed and stuff, and just getting all these different piano players on a record and stuff. Was there someone you learned from or you learned the ropes from? I mean, tell us about Buddy Charles for people who don't know about him.
Buddy Charles, yes. I didn't get to see him live as much as I should have. He was the longest, he had the longest run at the Acorn on Oak?
Acorn on Oak, right.
Acorn on Oak, which was not far from Gillies.
Yeah.
Yes, he was the... He was the piano player's piano player. He was just great with show tunes, and he's the kind of guy that would start a song, tell a story, break into a story, finish the song, go to another song. He had total command of the keyboard and a lot of stories in his head. But when I was little, the one who sort of inspired me was Buddy Greco.
Okay.
Because I used to watch him on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I would say to my parents, I want to be that guy. He's playing the piano and singing. That's what I want to do. And God listen, that's what I wound up doing.
That's what you wound up doing.
That's it.
Yeah. For both of you, how important is you both have great personalities. How important is that into getting the music across and stuff?
Sometimes if I do solo gigs with me and an acoustic guitar, that's all I've got.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like... There's no drum solos or guitar solos or instrumental breaks. So if I'm playing just on my own, I tell a lot of stories,
Yeah, me too. You know, I try to talk to the people when they come in. Sometimes you make friends with regulars. Sometimes I'm bad on names, but I always remember the song they wanted to hear. I would associate that face with that song, and I still do that. And, I just try to be, myself. That's all. You know, talk to them. How are you doing? You know, maybe I can make your day better. Maybe I can make you dance a little bit and enjoy your dinner. You know, depends on if I'm working a place where there's food served. That's it. It just seems to flow. You know,
what's your favorite song to play?
Oh, gee, I don't know. I do. I've always loved Sinatra. I mean, there's so many. Almost anything that he did. I like instrumentals too. I like some of the big band stuff. You know, I do Duke Ellington. I do. It's the list is so big. It's so big. You know, but I'm definitely a swing jazz type person. That's where I seem to excel in.
You mentioned earlier about young people coming up, 20-year-olds and stuff. What advice?
They used that, especially at Gillies. Yeah.
What advice would you give them?
Thanks. Well, first I say thanks for your parents for making you hear these songs. And as far as the new music that's coming out, I don't know what advice. I have 6 children myself, and I still have teenagers. I don't know what advice to give them. They like Sinatra. They like what I listen to. I like some of the stuff they listen to. Some of the stuff they listen to, I don't like. Then we turn separate ways, you know. But take everything in that there is out there, and there's so much there, you know, and you have to make your own opinions, I guess, on what you like.
Was there a Sinatra thing in Wales? I mean, I know you like Tom Jones and Cash, but...
Yeah, I was aware of Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra was cool. I mean, I think I was aware of him more from his movies than anything, as a kid. But, yeah, what was that great? The one with Bing Crosby that was there to show at Christmas.
Robin and the Seven Hoods?
Yeah, maybe that one. Yeah, that used to be on the TV.
Very good. That was about Chicago.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably my first idea of Chicago. Bing Crosby was wandering around dressed as Santa. You know.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break for the news. We're going to call Las Vegas. But thanks a lot for coming
thanks,
in and jamming. I'm very happy.
Happy New Year.
Okay, we'll be right back. Okay, thanks.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. Been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa.
Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. I'm Dave Hoekstra. This is our Nocturnal Journey segment. And we're going to Las Vegas tonight with Bruce Rickard. Bruce, are you there?
Yes, how you doing?
How you doing there, Bruce?
Doing great.
You're a guitarist in Cirque du Soleil, how do you say it, Mystère?
Mystère.
Mystère at the Treasure Island.
Yep.
And I'm really impressed with what you've done. We got a room full of musicians. We got Nick Russo here from Chicago and Johnny Langford. And you hold the Guinness Book of World Records for most theatrical performances by a male musician, 9,958 straight shows. Is that right?
That's correct. I actually did 10,000, but they only could account for 9,958. You know, back in the old days, 21 years ago, the show reports weren't as meticulously kept as they are today.
They were serious about this. I mean, I read that they went through timesheets and employees' records and stuff to see if this was all legit, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, I even had some a couple of testimonials from other artists who had not missed a show up until then, and I'm going to get the 10,000 kudos for in February. That's when they're going to we're going to add another 42 shows, I think, to bring it up to a nice even number of 10,000.
And you're going to go past that? You're not going to retire or anything, right?
Well, no. I'm going strong here.
I think John Langford, you've done about 9,000 shows in a row, haven't you, John? Tell us what the show is, actually. I want to send people there. So, yeah.
Well, it's the Cirque du Soleil show. So we have all kinds of acrobatics. We've got a live band with 10 musicians. And we've got an act that a trapeze act and a hand to hand act. We've got a bunch of things that are pretty unique to Cirque du Soleil as far as acrobatic and athletic things going on. So it's Cirque du Soleil show sort of marries the musical, theatrical, like rock opera. To meets circus, you know, that's the kind of thing. We don't have animals, though.
Just like this radio show. It's like you're the guitarist, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And tell us, we read a little about your background. You're from Canada, and I'm interested. You were in a blues. We were just playing some blues here. You were in a blues band around Montreal. So tell us about your entry into music.
Well, I started playing, as most musicians, I was about 13 or so. Started playing, school dances and stuff like that. And then when I found out that I could make some money doing this, I decided to go into the music business full time. I'd been playing professionally in Montreal for over 20 years when Cirque du Soleil composer Benoit Jutras called me. And the reason why he called me is because he used to work for me. As a matter of fact, I had as a band leader, I had about four or five Cirque du Soleil musicians work for me before they joined Cirque. So I used to joke around that I was the guy who didn't make the cut. But the thing is, I just didn't want to do the touring. I was doing a lot of touring before.
With the blues band?
With the blues band, with other stuff. I mean, I did all kinds of stuff, shows and I had my own thing going on, which was a more like for varied styles, Benoit Jutras called me up, and he says, "Hey, how you doing?" I said, "I'm doing fine." And he said, "Oh, by the way, how would you like to get a steady gig in Las Vegas?" I said, "You're out of your mind." And of course he wasn't, because he said, "Oh, look, the circus is opening up a permanent show in Las Vegas," and then he offered me the job, and I said, "Well, look, I'll check with my wife and family, make sure that, hey, it's okay with them, because it's a big move." But they said, hey, go for it. So that was 21 years ago.
And your show schedule is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Saturday, Sunday at 7 and 9:30 p.m.?
Correct.
You're calling. We're talking to you right now during an intermission or between shows? Or
yes, yeah. That's right, between shows. So okay. We're going to have another show at 9:30.
And you never missed one?
Never missed a single one.
Wow. I was going to say, like, I mean, what happens when you don't feel good, sick or hungover? You got snow there, right? Everybody was talking about snow in Las Vegas. I mean, have you come close to missing one?
Yeah, well, you know, coming from Montreal, and you guys are from Chicago, so you understand what I'm talking about you know, cold weather and snow and stuff like that. Of course, you know, the band didn't play when I didn't show up. So, you know, no play, no pay. So basically, you know, you have to show up. And that was basically the idea is that, you do whatever you can to be a team player and make everybody work.
Have you come close to missing a show? What's the closest you've come to missing a show?
Well, I've had a couple of things. I've had some, you know, back problems and things like that I was able to take care of. But there was one show, and it had nothing to do with being sick or hungover or anything like that. There was some work being done on one of the highways over here, the I-95, and they had two lanes closed. Well, that day, there was an accident. The traffic was backed up for miles, you know, and it was not moving. And so I was on my way to work, and it was about, you know, when I leave home, it was about like 5 o'clock, 5:15. And so showtime is 7 o'clock. So, you know, I'm stuck in traffic, and I'm calling ahead. And I'm saying, well, look, I'll be, you know, a few minutes late. I'm expecting to be there by, you know, 6:15 or something like that, because we usually do a sound check by at 5:40, say. So, so I said, well, I won't be able to make the sound check. Just, I'll be there. But anyways, half an hour later, the stage manager calls me up. He says, well, where are you? I said, about 100 feet further than when we were talking half an hour ago.
Wow.
So it was just awful. I made it to work at 10 minutes before showtime. I just threw my stuff on. I didn't even tie my shirt. You know, I was doing that on my way up to the stage. And then when the show opened, I was there ready to play.
When did the Guinness people get wind of this? I mean, how does that work? Or did your people tell them? Or when did they find out this was happening?
Well, yeah, the people from the fantastic people here at Mystère, they said, "Oh, this is really amazing. We got to do something about this," you know. So they let the people at Guinness Book of Records to know about this, and then Kitty over here, Karen Tomsig, she did all the research for all the pay stubs and stuff like that. She went through, I mean, piles of paperwork to make this possible.
Wow. Has anyone contested it? Like somebody with 8,322 shows in Reno or something, you know?
Well, if they did, I still beat them.
Yeah. That's right. So,
I think the previous record was 9,200. I think that's what's, but then I just blew that right off, you know.
It's a 90-minute show, right?
Yeah.
It's a 90-minute show.
What if you want to go on vacation?
Oh, well, you see, we got dark periods. As a matter of fact, next Thursday, we've got our yearly two-week period, vacation, and I'll be out of town. I'll be in Puerto Vallarta in the great sun and beach. It'll be great. And so, yeah, we do have, weeks off, but I mean, we do 478 shows a year, so we need a little bit of time off.
And you stand, you must stand then for the whole show. Do you stand?
I mean, yeah, but I do sit down, between the songs, I don't get to stand. Although, you know, in the beginning I used to stand up all the time, but then I said, hey, wait a minute. we get to, but I, you know, in the 90-minute show, I stand for about at least an hour and 10 minutes. So.
Okay, well, we got to wrap it up here. So thanks, Bruce. It's you reserve tickets for the show. It's called 1-800-392-1999 or www.treasureisland.com, right?
That's right.
Okay.
And you All right, Dan, it was my pleasure talking with you.
You have a good year and keep the streak going.
You betcha.
Okay. And that wraps up another edition of Nocturnal Journal. I'd like to thank everybody for hanging around. Thanks, Nick.
Thank
thanks,
you.
John.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks to Dan Long, Aubrey Mumpower. And we will see you next week with Chris Legan's record collection and Paul Seabar. We're going to talk about Cuban music. Thanks.